The first sermon in this series was called Esther, the book that doesn't mention God. This book, Esther, begins with that opening chapter with a proud, stubborn, yet easily swayed, capricious king named Ahasuerus and a queen who will not shame herself no matter what the cost, Queen Vashti. In the providence of God, these two people, Ahasuerus and Vashti, collide. And Vashti is vanished, I'm sure. And two more people emerge on the scene. But it is not your typical two biblical heroes by any stretch of the imagination. The two people that emerge onto the scene are a Jew named Mordecai and his cousin, Hadassah, otherwise known by her pagan name, Esther. These two, Mordecai and Esther, are certainly not, and I repeat, not the shining, sterling examples of biblical heroes. In fact, you have two people who are living voluntarily in captivity. The doors had been open for them to return long ago, and yet they did not. Although they are not the shining, sterling examples of a Joseph or a Daniel, rather they are bad examples in many ways. But in spite of their compromises, in spite of bad decisions, God uses them. Which is good news for us, because I would remind all of us that God's people are more often than not known for their warts, their foibles, their failures, and their sins. And the good news of God's word is that He uses people just like that, which means there's hope for us. In the course of the story, the prime minister, Haman, who is a wicked man, devises a plan to destroy the Jews because of really what is nothing more than a clan rivalry between his clan, the Agagites, and the clan that Mordecai belonged to, the tribe of Kish, which is Saul's tribe. Mordecai, at that point in the story, does actually step up and as it were, plays the man. But Esther is not so easily molded into heroic material. She actually needs to be coaxed, yea, even threatened. And God, although He's not mentioned on any of the pages in the book of Esther, is really at the center stage of the whole book. Because in a glorious display of poetic justice, God does away with Haman. Mordecai and Esther come through in the pinch. He exalts them to positions of power and prestige. God vindicates and avenges His people, keeping covenant with them. And on every single page, you see a most magnificent display of divine providence at work. Gift to the poor. Thus the Jews undertook what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. In the first description of the feast Purim, which many people believe ends up being one of the primary reasons the book of Esther is written, is to explain the feast of Purim. What we have is Purim as a sign of divine reversal. Mordecai, in verse 20, has recorded the events and then sent out letters. You know that those 127 provinces would have been in great anxiety, wanting to know what happened in the other provinces. We fared well here, but what happened there and there? And so Mordecai makes it known throughout the entire kingdom that this reversal, the divine reversal, had been successful. He sends out reports, and the people rejoice, no doubt. In the course of that report, what he does is he obligates, notice the word in the NAS, he obligates the Jews to celebrate the 14th and 15th day of the month of Adar. Mordecai was so deeply moved by what God had done that the natural thing to do was to say that in remembrance of what God has done, we will set these 2 days aside annually and make it an annual feast that you will remember from year to year.
Verse 22, the reasons are stated for the feast. First of all, they secured rest from their enemies. By the way, the word rest, of course, is supposed to conjure up a different Old Testament scenario. The scenario of being taken out of Egypt, delivered from the land of Egypt, delivered from the hand of Pharaoh and their enemies, given rest in the land of Canaan. There's another great reason, and that is what we might call the divine reversal. Their days were turned from sorrow into gladness. Thanks, Dave. God had reversed their sorrow into gladness. Am I supposed to read this side or this side? Okay. Turn from sorrow into gladness, and notice mourning into, NAS says a holiday. The Hebrew is just a yom tov, a good day. God turned their sorrow into gladness and their mourning into just a good day. And so, verse 23, the Jews enact Mordecai's ordinance. And what we see then is the establishment of the feast of Purim. Then in verses 24 to 28, there's a different angle that's brought in, which basically rehearses the story upon which the feast is based. Verse 24, for Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the adversary of all the Jews, had schemed against the Jews to destroy them and had cast Pur, that is the lot, to disturb them and destroy them. But when it came to the king's attention, he commanded by letter that his wicked scheme, which he had devised against the Jews, should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore they called these days Purim, after the name of Pur. And because of the instructions in this letter, both what they had seen in this regard and what had happened to them, the Jews established and made a custom for themselves and their seed, and for all those who allied themselves with them, so that they would not fail to celebrate these 2 days according to their regulation and according to their appointed time annually. In verses 24 to 27, we see, first of all, the rehearsal of the story in very short synopsis form. No doubt this perhaps is what part of what Mordecai himself wrote and reported to all of those throughout the provinces. And then in verse 26, the first part, it gives an explanation as to why it is called Purim. It is Haman who cast the poor, the lots, that created the whole problem, and then Purim becomes an established festival. Now notice, the custom is threefold: for themselves, for their seed or their descendants, and all of their, notice, their allies, those who allied themselves with them. You remember that throughout Israelite history, there is always an emphasis over and over and over again upon doing something for the next generation so that they will remember the mighty deeds of God. And so as Mordecai establishes the Feast of Purim, he has in mind not only that the Jews themselves would be mindful of what God had done for them, but also the next generation would be mindful, and then also those who had converted to the true and living God would also be reminded. Notice, the feast is to really root these events in their memories in such a way so that the text literally reads that the days would not pass away and memory fade from their seed. Verse 28, so these days were to be remembered and celebrated throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city. And these days of Purim were not to fail from among the Jews, or their memory fade from their descendants. Verse 29, then Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. He sent letters to all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, namely words of peace and truth, to establish these days of Purim at their appointed times, just as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had established for them, and just as they had established for themselves and for their descendants with instructions for their times of fasting and their lamentations. The command of Esther established these customs for Purim, and it was written in the book. The third depiction, as it were, of why the feast exists then brings another element into it, and that is Esther's own authority. Esther uses her authority as queen to confirm the feast. A second letter bearing both the authority of Prime Minister Mordecai and Queen Esther are stamped upon the second edict, and it reinforces the official authority of the feast. In other words, Esther and Mordecai want all of the Jews throughout all of the provinces to be celebrating this great act of deliverance. The letter itself is described as being words of peace and truth. That's the way the New American Standard translates it. The Hebrew text is words, davarim, of shalom va'emet, peace and faithfulness. The word in Hebrew for truth and faithfulness is one and the same word. In a sense, although God is not mentioned, he is, as it were, slipped in by stealth by words of peace and faithfulness. The letter is to obligate celebration for what God has done. Purim is all about, or is supposed to be all about, shalom, peace, welfare. Understand that for the Jew, peace is not simply the cessation of antagonism or war. It is a holistic view of welfare, health, and salvation. And so what the Prime Minister and the Queen seek to do is to introduce now within Jewish culture, especially in the diaspora, a sense of giving gratitude and thanks to God for what he had done. Also, in this repetition of the event, the fastings and lamentations are introduced, so that what the Feast of Purim ends up looking like is 3 days of fasting and lamentations, and then 2 days of feasting, partying, and giving gifts. A few observations about the feast itself. First of all, it does not carry the divine authority like Passover does. Passover and many of the other feasts that were revealed to Moses on Sinai came as direct revelations of God to be introduced into the life of God's people. Here, Purim comes not as a direct word from God, but as an effort on one man's part to instill in his people a sense of remembrance for what God has done. Although it is unlike Passover in that it lacks divine authority, it is like Passover in that it commemorates a great deliverance. Just as a side note, and I suppose this is unfortunate, its observance throughout the generations has become a rather riotous occasion for many Jews. In fact, Gail, I should have asked you beforehand if you celebrated the Feast of Purim. The rabbis in the Talmud argued or taught the people, you should drink so much that you can no longer, quote, distinguish between blessed be Mordecai and cursed be Haman. In the Feast of Purim, Esther is not read from the typical scroll. It's read from a letter, which is to hearken back to what was read in the book. Remember the letters that went throughout all the provinces, and through the reading, every time the name Haman is read, the boos and the hisses and the jeers from the congregation begin to emerge, and then every time Mordecai, the name Mordecai comes, there are cheers. I need to go to one of these just to see what it is like. Chapter 9, verses 20 through 32 really give us the rationale for the Jewish festival of Purim. But there is a sense in which, even though that may be the motive for the book being written to the Jews, the book can simply not stop there on that point or that final note. It has to end on a different note. Because ultimately, the book is not just about a feast. It is about a great deliverance that God had wrought for his people. And so the book, in the way that it approaches the subject with God being in the shadows, reintroduces Mordecai, the great hero of his people. Now in verse 1, we have something that seems strange and breaks the flow. Now King Ahasuerus, chapter 10, verse 1, laid a tribute on the land and on the coastlands of the sea. Now that is inserted, and commentators have about a dozen different reasons as to why that verse is inserted at that point after the Feast of Purim, right before the exaltation of Mordecai. Perhaps it was a note on the king's prosperity in spite of the fact that he did not receive anything from Haman's crooked and evil scheme. In other words, it may be simply reminding us that because he ultimately did what was right, God did bless him with the tribute for his country. You'll remember that Haman did promise him vast amounts of money if he could wipe out this troublesome people. Perhaps it's an underlying comment on how successful of a prime minister Mordecai was. Maybe the assumption is that through Mordecai's administration, more revenue was brought in to the king. Or, and of course we read it from this perspective probably more than any other, perhaps it's just a simple reminder what a burden Ahasuerus still was to the people. He continued to tax them. In other words, maybe the point of the verse is simply to say, God did a great thing for the people. He exalted two Jews who were at a place of power and prestige. But you know what? When push came to shove, the kingdom ran as business as usual. Whatever the case, it certainly is an odd insertion. And then verse 2, we have, and all the accomplishments of his authority and strength, and the full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Jews of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and in favor with his many kinsmen, one who sought the good for the welfare of his whole nation. Now, there is some disagreement as to, in verse 2, the his. It seems that the next earliest antecedent would certainly be Ahasuerus. Many argue that it is in reference to Mordecai himself. But the fact is that verse 1 moves from Ahasuerus to verse 2, which is about Mordecai, and his greatness is recorded. Now, there's a wonderful contrast here. You'll remember the greatness that Haman had achieved. Haman had to toot his own horn. Haman had to recount his own glory. And here's Mordecai, a humble man who somebody else praises. He is seen as one who certainly was great, who was a huge success in the place where God had put him. But in fact, what makes him perhaps the biggest hero of all is not simply that he was a great politician and a great administrator, a great prime minister, a huge success throughout King Ahasuerus' kingdom. His greatest achievement of all is that he, as a Jew, was in command of Ahasuerus himself. You'll remember another one who achieved such status, and that was Joseph. But there was more than just his exaltation. The text is very careful to tell us he was great among the Jews, and he had favor with his many kinsmen. Here's the man Mordecai, who at the beginning of the story, remember, tells Esther, don't tell them you're a Jew, don't tell them who your people are. And now, at the end of the story, he is one who is used mightily by God, who worked for the good of his people. The verse 3 tells us he spoke on behalf of the shalom of his people. When we look at Mordecai, what we see is we see one who is exalted to a place of power and position, and yet who remembers his people and works on their behalf. One of the commentators draws out these principles from Mordecai's exaltation. One, God's people can work effectively in the world. There is not necessarily a conflict between being a child of God and doing excellent work in a secular position. We need to remember, as we see Mordecai's success, the great principle that we heard at the referendum, that is, that every man has a calling, whether it is the calling of a shoemaker, or a dairyman, or a missionary, or a preacher, or a prime minister, every man has a calling, every man a station that God has put him in his life, and therefore he should do the very best that he can do in that place and time where God has him. The second observation, that promotions to positions of power do necessarily cause individuals to forsake their roots. Individuals are wisely not only to accomplish their own organization's goals, but also to the benefit of their own people. I don't know about you, but I wish we saw more of this. There are people who are committed deeply to the people God has called them to serve. And it is very possible to be taken to a place of promotion and a position of power and to be used by God, not forsaking the roots, but remembering the very people that God called them to serve. The third observation is that powerful people are able to often achieve much. In 10:1, the king affects the entire empire by exercising his power to levy a tax. In addition, Mordecai and Haman demonstrate this truth. Both make a major impact on the people of Medo Persia. The former works for the good of the people, the latter for the detriment. We need to remember that in a time and place where many within the church seem to be in one of two extremes. Isn't it true that we are always caught between extremes? There are those who think that we ought to do nothing, forget politics, forget the world, forget culture. And my friends, the truth is not in either of those extremes. The truth is in understanding the best job that we can. Number four. Being in power does not automatically or even necessarily corrupt one or make one proud. Don't you wish that were more common as well? Power may have corrupted Haman, but it does not appear to have affected Mordecai adversely. Whom God puts in a position, and yet, although he does a good job for the state, he does a good job for the king, who is certainly, let's face it, a doorknob, but God puts Mordecai in a place where he is able to serve the king, but also he is able to labor for his people, and it is that power that Mordecai uses to the benefit of his people, not being corrupted over the long term. Have you ever wondered why you will see somebody arising in the political scene who seems to have convictions that are strong, priorities that are firm and in place, and yet within just a few years of being in Washington, all of a sudden, they are no longer standing for the things that they stand for? Unfortunately, that seems to be the pattern, does it not? We have for ourselves constructed a political system where people with convictions certainly cannot survive over a long period of time. I saw the present governor of Arkansas, who is a Republican, a conservative Christian man, say that the thing that baffles him about our current president is that when he knew him years ago in Arkansas, he was for life. Power often corrupts the human heart. And in order for a human being to maintain whatever power they have achieved, they often need to do that very fundamental art of compromise and lower their convictions. But thanks be to God that there are some who will stand. Mordecai stands as an example to us that there can be people who attain high levels of position and yet stand firm on the principles that they have always held. In fact, we might say that Mordecai's convictions even strengthened over the years. Last, people recognize and appreciate true compassion in their leaders. Wonderful example in Mordecai. And in conclusion, as we look at the book of Esther, the book that doesn't mention God, we see in the pages of this marvelous book a blessed and enduring testimony of God's faithfulness to his people, even when they are not living at the top of the curve. The book that doesn't mention God is also a reminder to us of the magnificent mosaic of divine providence that God is weaving together. It is a reminder to us that even in the wicked schemes of wicked men, the hand of God has not been removed, but is indeed right there in the mix. And in our passage tonight, what we see is that there is something biblical and right and good in establishing memorials of God's faithfulness and his mighty deeds. As we look at this book, what we end up seeing at the end of the book is the establishment of a feast to remember God's mighty deeds. It is the establishment of those testimonies and those memorials which help our future faith and serve as a testimony to our children. Throughout all of the scriptures, whenever God had done something magnificent and wonderful, God's people put up memorials. When Joshua crossed Jordan, in Joshua chapter 4, he put 12 stones. And God specifically says, when your children ask you, what are these stones, you can tell them. In chapter 24, he puts up another pillar at Shechem. Samuel, in Israel's victory over the Philistines in 1 Samuel chapter 7, raises a monument that he calls Ebenezer. Here I raise my Ebenezer, hither by thy help I'm come. Ebenezer, God has helped. Why are the memorials so necessary? Why did Mordecai feel the absolute compulsion to establish this and to have the authority of both queen and prime minister on this feast? One very simple reason. We have a tendency to forget. The psalm that Dave read this morning, bless the Lord, O my soul, bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Forget not his benefits. My friends, you and I suffer from the fall, a form of spiritual amnesia that compels us to often forget the things that God has done. Why is it that we run into Panic Palace every time a rough time comes along? I'll tell you one of the reasons. It's because we don't have enough memorials to look back upon because we've not erected them. Oh, God has been at work. And if we would but have those memorials, if we would but somehow commemorate those mighty deeds with in creative ways, then the next time we entered into difficulty, do you know what those memorials would do? They would strengthen our hope that God would indeed intervene on our behalf once again. There is a tremendous danger in just forgetting. In fact, if you find yourself in a place of spiritual declension, a place of spiritual backsliding, can I tell you one of the problems is that you have simply forgotten. You have forgotten the mighty deeds of God. You have by and large forgotten his kindnesses. You have forgotten the magnificent displays of power and deliverance that he has wrought in your life. And all of a sudden, you are being sucked into a spiritual declension because you simply will not remember his benefits. The book of Esther teaches us, commemorate God's mighty deeds. I think perhaps the greatest lesson in Esther, though, does not in the long run end up being God's providence or even the necessity of remembering. But both of those are vitally important. The greatest message in the book of Esther is that there would be one who would come who would be greater than Mordecai. Have you ever noticed in our Lord's discourse when he says, something greater than Solomon is here, something greater than Jonah is here, something greater than the temple is here? I think he could have just as easily added, something, someone greater than Mordecai is here. Mordecai indeed was a great intercessor for his people. He labored for their good. He sought their shalom. He was the people's hero. But there would be one who would come from Mordecai's race who would be greater than Mordecai could ever imagine. S.G. DeGraff notes that Mordecai served the king as his prime minister. In his exaltation, he did not forget his people. With strong ties, he remained bound to his people and his people to him. His whole administration was geared to the well-being of his people, and he continually pleaded their cause with the king. This makes us think of our mediator, who in his exaltation continuously remembers his people. He too has the power over all things in his hands. In his hand is sovereign rule. He continually has the best interest of his people in mind. Of that mediator, Mordecai was no more than a type. For the sake of that mediator, God showed his grace to his people in the days of Mordecai. If only the Jews would come to understand that when they celebrate the Feast of Purim, they are looking to a mediator who is greater than Mordecai. Let us, therefore, look to our mediator who always remembers his people. Let's give thanks for the book of Esther, the book that, although it does not mention God, his glory is displayed on every page.